From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. When you picture someone playing the blues, you imagine someone who's been through the school of hard knocks. I got me a booty woman. Man with bell on me. Well, the person singing there has been to school, all right. High school. He's 16 years old. He sings like a man and manhandles his guitar, but when he and his fellow bandmates break into giggles, it's clear they're all kids. The three Perry siblings are 9, 14, and 16 years old, and they call themselves the Homemade Jams Blues Band. Home for them is Tupelo, Mississippi. That's where they recorded their CD, Pay Me No Mind. It's where they make their instruments by hand. And it's where they caught an early case of the blues listening to their father's collection of B.B. King recordings. The oldest, Ryan, picked up the guitar at age 7. His brother followed with an electric bass, and their baby sister rounded out the trio when she picked up drumsticks. The three are now regulars on the blues festival circuit. The three siblings that make up the Homemade Jams Blues Band are here with me in Studio 4A, and we should note that that's Jams, J-A-M-Z. They're here along with their parents, Trish and Renaud, who drove them to Washington. Welcome to Studio 4A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Now, I want to hear a little bit about these instruments. They're incredible. I want you to tell me a little bit about what you play and your role in the band. I'm going to begin with you, Kyle.
I'm playing a six-string muffler guitar, and I'm the bass player in the band.
A muffler guitar. We're going to hear more about that in just a little bit. This is no guitar like I've ever seen. And Kyle, how old are you?
14.
Okay. And Taya?
I'm 9.
And you play?
I play the drums.
Ryan?
I'm 16 years old, and I play the six-string electric guitar, muffler guitar.
Again, that muffler guitar. We'll hear more about that in a minute. Now, how did you come together as a band? Because it's one thing to listen to the blues, but when did you decide that you wanted to play music? And I guess first it was just the two of you, Ryan and Kyle, right?
Yes, I was playing the guitar. I was putting guitar lessons, and I was doing, you know, pretty well in it. I was learning notes, though. And the material that, you know, he was teaching me wasn't what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn blues. I wanted to learn, you know, B.B. King, Albert King, Stevie Ray Vaughan, all those artists. So I believe I went through three instructors in the, three, 4 years. And one day, my dad then became a police officer, and he found this old blues player by the name of Jabbo, and he persuaded in his uniform to...
I should note that the quotation marks wiggled your fingers. He persuaded.
Persuaded. He was, I believe he was on duty when he persuaded him to, you know, to teach me a little bit. And the next weekend, I was on his front porch learning the blues, and that was one of the best days I've ever had, and he was teaching me everything that I needed to know, everything that I wanted to know, and it was just great.
Renaud, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Ryan said that you persuaded him to sit down with your son. You were working as a police officer. It sounds like there's a story there.
Right. Well, I used to be a police officer, and I knew that if I go to this guy's house as just a regular person, he was going to say no. That is what I kept running into all the time. Most artists that has a unique talent, such as the blues, they're really old and cranky, and they don't want to deal with kids at all. So, you know, I said, well, I'm on duty. I'll swing by there in my police car and my uniform, and he was out cutting grass, and we laugh about it today, but when he saw me pulled up, he said he, you know, his mind got to racing, like, man, what have I done, you know? And he got to thinking, you know, and so I got out the car, and I said, hey, are you Jabbo? He's like, yes, sir, I'm Jabbo. And I said, well, I have a 12-year-old that can play already, you know, but he really wants to play blues. And, of course, he wanted to tell me no, but, you know, by me being in that uniform, he's like, well, just bring him by on Saturday. And I did, and they rocked that porch, I mean, they had that porch going in no time. And at the end of the session, that man looked at me and said, you know, this kid, I want to teach him everything I know. And that's how it happened.
So you did what you had to do.
I did what I had to do.
So, Kyle, did you take lessons from Jabbo also?
I did take lessons from Jabbo. He taught me, you know, how to finger pick bass pretty good. Taught me on bass lines that I was having trouble with, and he just helped me out.
Well, I'd like to hear some music from you. Your father, Renaud, wrote all the songs on the CD except one, 10 of the 11 songs. We're going to hear Penny Waiting on Change, which is a great song. And Taya, tell us what the song is about.
Well, it's about, I don't really know. I just sit back there and play the drums.
Well, let's hear it.
All right.
Hello, everybody. Well, I ain't never been hurt this way. Hello, everybody. Well, I ain't never been hurt this way. See, I woke up this morning feeling like $1 million. But before the sun fell, I felt like a penny waiting on change. Listen there. Woman came by my house today with tears pouring down her face. She said, man, you better sit down before you fall down, 'cause this here news is gonna knock you flat on your face. Woke up this morning feeling like $1 million. Now I just feel like a penny weighing on change. Said, man, the woman ain't coming back home, 'cause her husband took my place. Should have seen the look on my face.
Taya and Kyle Perry, they are the Homemade Jams Blues Band, and they're assisted by their father, Renaud, on the harmonica. Now, Ryan and Kyle, when you introduced yourselves, you said you both play muffler guitars. These guitars that you're playing are unlike anything I have ever seen. Can you describe that for me?
Well, it's just The muffler right here is the body of the guitar.
And we should say a car muffler. A car muffler that you normally find under the chassis of a car. Yes.
And basically what we did was bolted on the neck, took the electronics from a regular guitar, and just shoved them in the body of this muffler. On the back of it is a license plate covering the giant hole that we cut in it. And we have exhaust tips that we put at the end of the guitars.
Okay, and they're both hanging from your shoulders via seatbelt straps.
Yes, via seatbelt straps.
Now, when your father hands you these lyrics, as we said, he wrote the lyrics, wrote actually most of the songs on the CD. The lyrics are very adult. It must be a little bit odd for you to sing some of these songs. I mean, you're singing about life experiences that I'm assuming that you have not yet had.
No, not yet. Not yet. But it's just putting yourself in the frame of mind. You know, when he hands me a sheet of music and I get the subject, he shows me how to sing it. So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, you know, say the song's about this guy losing his woman. He hands me the music, say, okay, I'm a guy, I just lost my woman. How am I going to sing this? How am I going to play this? How, you know, how's the mood of the song going to, you know, be?
But, you know, I've always heard that you have to live the blues to be able to sing the blues. You have to know what it's like to have somebody step on your heart, to know what it's like to have hungry children at home that you can't feed, to have lost your job and your best friend and had your dog run over by a pickup truck all on the same day. How do you actually sing the blues if you haven't lived the blues?
To this day, I still don't know. I think it's just a talent, that a natural talent that we all have, a God-given talent. And I think we're all grateful to have that talent. And hopefully none of those experiences will hit us too hard if we have them. But if they do, you know, they'll do nothing but help us in our career.
Ryan Perry, Taya Perry, Kyle Perry, assisted on harmonica by Dad, Renaud Perry, and assisted by Mom, Trish, who helped get you here. Thanks so much for being with us. This is the Homemade Jams Blues Band. Their CD is called Pay Me No Mind, and can you take us out with that title track?
No problem.
All right, guys.
You can watch a video of the band performing with their muffler guitars, and you can hear two more songs they played for us. You'll find that in the music section of our website. That's npr.org.
All right. Two pretty women sitting over yonder. I never look my way.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Okay, so you're ready for summer vacation. The bags are packed. The airplane tickets are in hand. The neighbor said he'd water your lawn. There's just one nagging question. What book should you take? Librarian Nancy Pearl is here with some answers. They're what she calls great airplane reads. And this first book that I'm holding up actually has a man holding a suitcase. It's called The Arrival by Sean Tan. Am I saying the name correctly?
You are. And this is a fabulous, fabulous book. It's a book without words, and yet it tells a really complicated story. It's a picture book, but it's not intended for young readers. And what it is the story of a man who leaves his homeland to come to a new country. And you get the scenes in just wordless, wonderful, wonderful pictures of everything that happens when he says goodbye to his family. And there's one picture in there, Steve, where his wife and his daughter and he are all holding hands and then letting go. And that's a picture, I think, that just will break your heart. And what Sean Tan does in that book so wonderfully is really universalize the sense of what it's like to come to a new world.
I suppose we should mention, when we say that this is going to a new world, this isn't exactly someone going to New York, but you see the person in the harbor.
Right.
City behind the harbor looks kind of New York-y. Here's somebody in what must be the immigration hall. It looks a little bit like Ellis Island. It's an extraordinarily strange version of New York, but this seems to be where the person is going.
But it's surreal enough so that it both takes a common situation, the immigrant coming to America, and yet at the same time, because it's not quite the America that we know, it just adds that kind of surreal dimension to it.
So the first in our stack about great airplane reads is about someone taking a long journey. And let's pick one of the smaller books here, Robin McKinley, Sunshine. According to the blurb, it's pretty much perfect.
I have rarely met anyone who's read Sunshine who has not loved it. It's the story of a young woman named Ray Seddon who is driving home one morning from making cinnamon rolls at her stepfather's coffee house when she runs into a group of vampires. It turns out that she is going to be used as bait for this very enigmatic vampire named Constantine. Mm-hmm. Constantine overcomes his natural desires to do with her as vampires tend to do, and Ray discovers in herself the means to get them both out of this very sticky situation. And then her troubles really begin. Oh. Now, what Robin McKinley does in this book so well is mix the real and the fantastical. When you start the book, for the first 15 pages, there are like clues here or there that this is not the world that we really know, although everything is very familiar. Cinnamon rolls. And then all of a sudden, there's a line that says, but when the voodoo wars happened, and then you think, wait, what world am I in?
So we've got two books in a row here that start with the real world and make it strange.
Three books,
new.
Actually.
Oh, we've got
There's another one.
Which one?
The Thin Place.
The Thin Place. Catherine Davis, a novel.
Now, what you want in an airplane book, you want a book that is complex enough that you're drawn into it so you can forget that you're having this elbow war with the person next to you over the armrest and you can overcome your anger at the person in front of you who's tilted his seat back into your lap. Mm-hmm. So you want a book that really grabs you and takes you away.
And something that when you're forced to hold it about 4 inches from your face,
yes,
because of that seat, it still reads pretty well. You want
right,
a nice font.
And
nice
yet you
font.
Don't want something so complex that when it's interrupted by those announcements of putting on your seatbelt, etc.,
yeah,
that you're going to lose your place and never be able to recapture it. So you don't want plotless wonders. And The Thin Place is one of those mesmerizing, mysterious books that does exactly that. And this is how it begins. There were three girlfriends and they were walking down a trail that led to a lake. One small and plump, one pretty and medium-sized, one not so pretty and tall. This was in the early years of the 21st century. The unspeakable having happened so many times, everyone was still in shock, still reeling from what they'd seen, what they'd done or failed to do. The dead souls no longer wore gowns. They'd gotten loose, broadcasting their immense soundless chord through the precincts of the living. Mm. So you get this beautiful writing. And you get this mysteriousness, and it's set in a small town near the Canadian border and named Varennes. And Varennes is a thin place. It's a place that is where the border between the real and the inchoate, between the living and the dead, is very permeable.
And should we draw anything from the fact that Catherine Davis, the author, is recorded here as having received a Kafka Prize?
Indeed.
The next book we have here is from Thomas Perry, Metzger's Dog.
The thing that should tell you everything you need to know about that book is that Metzger is a cat. Add to that that it's a thriller, and it's about some urban terrorists who are determined to take down Los Angeles.
Do you mind? I just flipped it open
yes,
at random here and came
do.
To classic Raymond Chandler writing here. Chinese Gordon's body was hunched forward over the steering wheel, his right foot still on the gas pedal, and his teeth clenched as the van knifed into the space between two cars and shot up the harbor freeway. Love it! Love it.
And it's just a lot of fun. It's one of those getting lost in on the airplane books.
Well, let's travel through one more book in the stack.
Okay.
One
the
more.
Other thing is just a wonderful picture book, which if you're traveling with a 4 to 7 year old, this is a book that I think that you would really, really like. Now, we always hear the term when we're talking about literary fiction, metafiction, which is basically fiction about fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But Chester by Melanie Watt is the first meta picture book that I've ever run across. Now, maybe there are others, but I have not found them. So the book opens with Melanie Watt, the author, explaining that she's trying to write and illustrate a book about a mouse, but her cat, Chester, does not care for that idea. He thinks that it's his book and he is in charge of creating it. So there's Melanie trying to write her picture book and there's Chester with his red magic marker in hand or in paw. Melanie thinks she's gotten the upper hand of Chester because she has a picture of him in a pink tutu. And this is a huge insult to Chester, who believes that his name stands for charming, handsome, envy of mouse, smart, talented, envy of Melanie, really handsome. Chester comes up with his own revenge on Melanie. And I think what is so much fun about this is to get some 4 to 7 year old talking about whose book is it really? Is it Chester's book or is it Melanie's? And who's won that battle between them?
I already know what the kid's going to say to that.
The cat.
No. The kid's going to say, it's my book.
Oh, that's right.
Nancy Pearl, great to have you come by.
Thank you, Steve.
You can see illustrations from Chester and The Arrival and read excerpts of Nancy Pearl's other book recommendations at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in Your Health, we continue our series on European countries that provide health insurance for all their citizens at a fraction of the cost that the U.S. spends on health care. NPR's Joseph Shapiro went to France to look into its system and joins us now to talk about that. And Joe, we all, I think, heard of the French health care system, and what we've heard is it's good health insurance and it costs less than health care costs here in America. How is that possible?
You know, Renee, the government plays a big role in health care, and it keeps costs down. It collects payroll and income taxes for a national insurance fund. There are negotiations with medical unions to set doctors' fees, and government regulates most hospital costs. But although the government insurance system pays most of a person's health care costs, it doesn't pay all of them. And to pay the rest, the French also buy private insurance, or like Americans, they get it through their employers.
So pretty familiar in a certain way, as you've just described it. What was the biggest difference that you found?
What struck me in France is that the sicker you are, the more coverage you get. There are 30 conditions like cancer, diabetes, mental illness, where the National Health Fund picks up all the costs.
Which sounds expensive for the government.
Well, it is. It's one of the most expensive systems in Europe, and it's run deficits of billions of dollars a year. So benefits are being cut and more charges are being shifted to patients. But still, it's not as expensive as in the U.S. The French spend about half as much per person, and the money seems to go farther. So this morning, I want to show you what we found out when we looked into the care for new mothers and their babies. At the Dome Basilica of Sacré-Cœur, a violinist plays the favorites for the tourists. This is the highest spot in Paris, and the city spreads out below like a stage set. We've come to Paris to meet two young American mothers who live here. France embraces new mothers, with things like nurses who make home visits and months of paid job leave before and after a baby is born. To the French, it's not a luxury. It's an investment in healthy families and children.
Bless you.
On this cheery spring day, Marie-Lou Sarrazin takes us to the gardens behind the basilica. She finds a bench in the sun with her baby.
Ludovine, Ludovine, you're the prettiest baby I've ever seen.
Her daughter Ludovine was born in November.
You don't walk, nor can you talk, but somehow you stole my heart, oh yeah. Let's do the Ludovine dance.
Mother and baby get approving smiles from people who pass by. Mary Lou says pregnant women and new mothers seem to hold a special status here.
In France, it just seems that it's so family-oriented. A pregnant woman is seen and regarded as a very special moment.
But it wasn't so special back in the United States. She came to Paris to teach English. She got pregnant. She married. Her visa expired, so she returned to New York to complete her graduate studies and to have the baby at home. But already pregnant, she couldn't find insurance she could afford. She did get some coverage through New York Medicaid, the state program for the poor and uninsured. But that just covered her prenatal care. Once the baby was born, she'd be uninsured again.
I just felt like when I was in New York, it's always like stress, stress, stress. I just didn't like the care I was receiving, and I didn't want to stress out about something that I shouldn't have to stress out, not during the time of my pregnancy.
So Mary Lou headed back to Paris. Today, she says she misses the United States, but if she and her French husband have more children, she says they'll stay in France.
Bonjour. Hi. Hi, sweetie.
We meet a second American mother, Tanya Blumstein. She and her husband, Thomas Lachronique, pick up their 14-month-old daughter, Ella, at the apartment of a neighborhood daycare provider. Even this private daycare is heavily subsidized by their French health insurance. After college, Tanya moved to France to work in the film industry. She met Thomas, but then his company sent him to work in New Jersey, so they traveled back and forth. When Tanya got pregnant, she moved to Manhattan to be with him.
and there she tried to buy health insurance for herself. Every American insurer turned her down. The reason? She was pregnant. Although the insurance agents had their own less pleasant ways of describing it.
Because they said we don't insure a house on fire. I had a pre-existing condition, which was pregnancy. I couldn't believe it.
In the States, Thomas had Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, but Tanya couldn't get on his policy because they weren't married yet. So?
We got married.
Down to City Hall in New York.
It wasn't the wedding they'd planned.
A lot of people don't even know we're married because I want to do something, you know, as we had hoped to do, a little more spiritual than, you know, next.
Once they were married, Tanya did get on her husband's insurance, but even then they found the American system daunting. Tanya pulls out a stack of papers from that time.
I have my notes here. I was trying to navigate all this, and so my questions, I was like, wait, what is deductible out of network? What is coinsurance? Will they pay at New York rate if submitted to local, because it was a New Jersey thing, and, you know, first visit 3,000, follow-up 175, out-of-pocket, L&D packages 5,000.
Tanya and Thomas loved living in New York and to be in a country where there's so much choice and it's so easy to be a consumer. Except, as they found out, when it comes to health care.
Everything is so simple when you want to get a cab or rent a car, eat fast food. But once it gets to serious issues, your health, then it gets hellish. Really, it's really complicated.
So Tanya left Thomas in New York and returned to Paris to have her baby. Thomas later changed jobs to be with his family in France.
The French system, it's easy, it's clear. For example, this is something after Ella was born, and it says, I'm translating in French, since the birth of your daughter, Ella, the health insurance covers all of the fees, and it explains, you know, in the third month, between this date and this date, fourth month, fifth month, sixth month, and this, no matter what, you don't even pay a cent.
There's a neighborhood health clinic where she can show up with the baby anytime, even without an appointment. And when Ella got a stomach flu earlier this year, a doctor made a house call at 3 in the morning on a Sunday. It was all paid for by health insurance. This is the kind of comprehensive coverage that gets France's healthcare rated the best in the world by the World Health Organization. One key to making the system work are the local government nurses who make home visits to pregnant women and to parents and their babies. Today, the nurse is wearing black Chuck Taylors. Nadege Ertebis is making a home visit to the brightly painted apartment of a mother and father whose son was born 2 weeks ago, here in the town of Chartres.
Comment allez-vous?
Ah, ben ça va.
Ça va, ouais.
Ça fait deux semaines, c'est bon.
The nurse asks about how the baby sleeps and eats. She tells the parents about vaccination schedules, well baby visits, and about their options for subsidized daycare. She weighs the baby, then watches the mother breastfeed to see if there are any problems. The visit takes an hour. It costs the young parents nothing. There's not even any paperwork to sign.
Merci, bon courage.
One thing the nurse doesn't do is the family's laundry. Americans may think otherwise, especially if you saw the Michael Moore documentary Sicko. There's a memorable scene where a state worker goes to a new mother's home to do her wash. Back at the nurse's office, I meet her boss, Dr. Marie-Paul Martin. She saw Sicko, too.
I had a great laugh. With Michael Moore, it's very caricatural.
A caricature, she says, because only on occasion, like when there's a medical complication after birth, does a state-paid housekeeper do a mother's laundry. Still, even without laundry service, the French health system ran almost $9 billion in deficit last year. That's forced cuts in some health care. But the basic benefits to mothers and their children remain the same. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And there's more on how France's healthcare system stacks up against other European countries and America at npr.org/yourhealth.
Finally this hour, if you're looking for a thriller to read, Brad Meltzer has a suggestion. He's the author of a stack of best-selling thrillers. It's no surprise, then, that one of his favorite books is in that same genre. Here's Brad Meltzer with his pick for our series, You Must Read This.
When I was 19 years old, oy, I already sound like an old man. But that's the point. When I was 19, my dreams were even bigger than my hair, which is saying something. And it was in the midst of those dreams that I first read the novel Replay by Ken Grimwood. Replay has a simple premise. In chapter one, the main character, a 43-year-old man, sits at his desk and drops dead of a heart attack. When he wakes up, he feels odd, taking in familiar old smells, old sights, and he realizes he's back in college in his freshman dorm room. He's 18 again, with all the memories of his 43-year-old life. He gets, as the title says, to replay his life. And this time, he's no dummy. He doesn't marry the wife he knows he'd one day divorce. He bets on the 69 Mets and makes a ton of cash. He's rich and rich and rich. And he turns 43, drops dead, again. When he wakes up, he's now in his junior year of college. And this time he realizes that money doesn't matter as much as he thought. So he lives a different life until he turns 43, dead, again. When he wakes up, he's now in his 20s. The space between death is shrinking, and he keeps dying. But what cracks the book wide open is when the main character is flipping through the newspaper one day and sees a classified ad that says, "If you know who Lee Harvey Oswald is, call me." This is pre-1963, and the hero of Replay now realizes he's not the only one out there reliving his life. But the best part of Replay isn't the plot. The best part is that the book is about you. Yes, you. The moment Ken Grimwood has his authory hooks in you, you can't help but look at your own life. You can't help but think, what would I do differently if I could live my life again? What would I do differently? But by the time the hero lives his bohemian life in Paris, still not the perfect life, you realize this book isn't a thriller, it's an instruction manual. You should never live your life looking backward. You live your life by going forward. So how much do I love this book? When I was 22 years old, I worked at Games Magazine. I had no money, a $359 apartment, and $10,000 in college debt. And the first thing I did with all the cash I didn't have? I tried to track down Ken Grimwood and buy the movie rights for this book. I didn't just love Replay. I believed in it. I dreamed of it. I wanted this book that only I had found. And that's when his agent told me the film rights had been snatched up years ago. Years later, when I first found Google, I again found myself searching for Ken Grimwood. That's when I found that he died in 2003. And when I also realized I wasn't his only believer. At the time, there were fan sites dedicated to Replay. Hundreds of people, like the fellow replayers we never realize are out there, all of them dreaming my same dream. But as any true believer or replayer knows, there's a strange, odd power in knowing you're not alone in this world.
Brad Meltzer is a best-selling author, most recently of The Book of Lies. He lives in Florida. The recommendation you just heard was the novel Replay by Ken Grimwood. For more You Must Read This recommendations, you can go to our website. That's at npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. A hotel receptionist in England felt a little vibration she thought was her cell phone in the upper pocket of her jacket. It was not. At lunch, 19-year-old Abby Hawkins investigated, and from her bra, she plucked out a sleeping baby bat. She figures the tiny bat snuggled into the bra as it hung on the clothesline. Hawkins was shocked, but also sorry to disturb it. As she put it, it looked quite snug in there. The terrified bat was freed.
This Thursday morning is the day that the Food and Drug Administration is considering whether to warn you about possibly risky medication. There is a possible link between epilepsy drugs and suicidal thoughts and actions. In January, the FDA warned doctors about this. As with antidepressants, the relationship between epilepsy drugs and suicide may be difficult to establish, and already the FDA is getting pushback on its proposed warning. We have more this morning from NPR's Joanne Silberner.
You might think that Ginny Miller, of all people, would want beefed-up warnings about a possible risk of suicidal thoughts and actions associated with epilepsy drugs. Her son Sam, who has been on the drugs for several years, tried to kill himself a year and a half ago. Miller talks to a lot of patients and parents through a listserv. She says many were scared off by a warning issued to doctors in January.
If you read the warnings on all these epilepsy medications, they scare you to death just reading the warnings that are already on there. I think people will be more scared than they need to be.
And avoid the drugs and risk the accidents or even brain damage that can accompany seizures. The FDA is asking an advisory committee to consider evidence of an 80% increase in the risk of suicidal thoughts or actions. Put another way, the FDA says 4 of every 1,000 people on epilepsy drugs say they feel suicidal or have tried to kill themselves. But neurologist Alan Ettinger is concerned. He's on the board of the Epilepsy Foundation, an interest group for people with epilepsy. He also has research grants from drug manufacturers to study epilepsy drugs.
The Epilepsy Foundation and many of us in the field of epileptology believe this is a premature move to make.
The American Academy of Neurology agrees. The problem, as with the antidepressants, is that all the FDA has to work with are studies done years ago, and patients weren't directly asked about suicidal thoughts or actions. Kelly Posner of Columbia University set up the system the agency used to analyze the data.
There are limitations to how much you can interpret from it. Specifically, it doesn't necessarily tell us that this is a causal link.
Still, the findings of a link between epilepsy drugs and suicidal thoughts and actions are statistically significant, and the FDA can only act on the information it has now. The FDA does have supporters on this, even longtime critic Sid Wolf. He's director of Health Research Group, a part of Public Citizen.
Patients are very interested in understanding and very interested in being able to use drugs that they need to use as safely as possible, as opposed to being kept in the dark and then all of a sudden some tragedy befalls them and you sort of say, well, if they had known, they would have paid attention to the early warning signals.
Complicating the question is the incidence of depression in people with epilepsy, about 30% to 50%. Depression itself can lead to suicide. Neurologist Alan Ettinger says that even though he opposes the warning, something good could come out of it.
I'm hoping that this will at least inspire clinicians to spend the necessary time that's needed to query their patients about potential depression and anxiety that many individuals are suffering from and may be disinclined to spontaneously tell their doctors.
Ettinger says neurology researchers are discussing ways to determine whether these drugs really do promote suicidal thoughts or actions, but a clear answer is years away. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.